Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. We're going to talk about diets that fail, most of them do, and diets that work, and what's wrong with sugar. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. Well, most diets work for a while, especially if you can get through that high craving period in the first 3 to 4 weeks. But then off the wagon you fall if you're like most of us. We live in a lab-driven food system in which foods are engineered to appeal to our craving sensors with fat, salt, and sugar, especially sugar. It is now estimated that as much as 80% of food is laced with added sugar. Break the sugar habit and watch what happens. A simple lifesaver is shockingly sweet. A single glass of wine after abstaining for a few months is head spinning. Suddenly you begin to realize how your body adapts to whatever you put in it, hanging on to weight and demanding more of the addictive stuff, especially sugar. Now, sugar isn't poison, but it does have a serious effect on our bodies, as you're about to hear. We have research from neuroscientist Dr. Nicole Avena of Columbia University's Obesity Research Center. It's pretty interesting, I'll tell you that. Wait until you discover what symptoms can occur if you decide to get off sugar and stop eating a high-carb diet. And the new research about the price we pay for consuming as much sugar as we do. The key question is whether you can live happily on the kind of eating plan Dr. Avena recommends. She says you'll probably eat more than you did before and lose weight. No, you will not be snacking on freeze-dried cicadas, that I promise. Dr. Avena, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
It's good to have you here. So this Obesity Research Center at Columbia, what do you do there?
So there I have a lab where we're mostly interested in looking at appetite regulation and brain mechanisms that drive people to eat in ways that are sometimes unhealthy. And so we do lots of different experiments, mostly in rats, but we also do some experiments in humans as well, really just trying to understand what is it about the food that we eat that makes us want to eat it or not want to eat it.
So this idea of salt, sugar, fat, everything being engineered with those things in mind, either as chemical substitutes or with the real thing, that's what's doing it, correct?
Yeah, so we've been doing some experiments trying to understand what is it about the foods in our modern food environment that makes it sometimes difficult for people to control their intake. Many people will report that although they, you know, might just try to have one little tiny sliver of cake or maybe just a handful of potato chips, there's something about those particular types of food products that once they get started, it's often hard to put the brakes on and stop. And so we've been looking at specific ingredients in the foods to try to figure out why this is so problematic for some people. And the research that we've been doing has actually been discovering that there are changes in the brain and behaviors that emerge, particularly in response to added sugars, that in many ways look like what you would see with a drug of abuse.
So the same as cocaine?
Yeah, and so we're seeing parallels with the effects that you would see in drugs of abuse, such as cocaine or nicotine or alcohol.
Why is it? I'm a potato chip nut, a certain brand, my favorite, and it is hard to stop eating them. And, there are little school-size lunch packs, but that's never enough. You know, I need two of those.
Right.
So what is happening inside my brain and body with regard to potato chips?
Right. So what we think is happening is that the potato chips, they contain carbohydrate in the form of a starch. Mm-hmm. And so what we think is happening is that by constantly eating those types of foods, and it might not just be that you're constantly eating potato chips, but even though you might not even realize it, you're probably consuming way too much sugar than you should be to begin with. There's been recent statistics that show that the average American is consuming 22 teaspoons of added sugar each day. Now, added sugar is the sugar that's put into the food on top of the sugar that's already there naturally, like in the form of fructose or glucose that's in fruits and some vegetables. And so we're consuming way too much sugar, and what seems to be happening is that it seems to be sensitizing our brains in some way that causes us to then get a stimulation of this brain reward pathway when we eat things that are sweet or things that contain carbohydrates. And what happens is it seems to be set into overdrive in much ways like we would see when someone takes a drug of abuse. The system gets hyperstimulated and overactivated. And then that leads to this vicious cycle that seems to emerge of needing to consume more and more to feel that same pleasure or that same euphoria that you used to get maybe from just a couple of bites of the food. Mm. But then also the sort of negative side of it, so the withdrawal or the, you know, negative component that you get if you go for a while without eating those types of foods, or if you say, hey, guess what, I'm going to quit, I'm going to go on a healthy eating plan, cut out all the junk food. Well, your brain adjusts to that by going into withdrawal, and you start to feel lethargic and tired and cranky. And so these symptoms of addiction can emerge, and they seem to perpetuate themselves.
Let's take, because when I was explaining we were going to have this conversation together, everybody said chocolate. Ask about chocolate. So people are being pretty careful, a lot of people I know, and they've switched to the darkest chocolate that they can tolerate because they feel it has less sugar. So let's say 85% cacao chocolate bars, that dark. Can something with that little sugar in it trigger your whole sugar thing, or is that allowable?
Well, you know, I think it depends on the individual, and that's why in the book, Why Diets Fail, I talk about how, you know, there really is no one-size-fits-all approach. Every diet plan out there, and especially ones that are going to work, need to be tailored to the individual. Some people seem to be more sensitive to sugars and carbohydrates than others. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, some people find that, you know, candies and cookies are the things that lead them to not be able to control their intake, but they're fine with breads and pastas. Whereas other people that I've talked to really can't control their intake of any of those things. And it seems to be all carbohydrates seem to really set them off. So I think it depends on the individual. Certainly the higher concentrated cocoa in the chocolate is going to be better because it has less sugar in it. So the higher you can tolerate, the better it is.
I recently came upon a company that makes raw chocolate bars. And so I gather these are cacao beans with a little bit of cocoa butter in them and no sugar. So it's a raw product, and it was delicious. And I was and very low in calories. I was very surprised by this and, you know, found it quite delicious. Did I like it as much as a dark chocolate bar? No, but good enough.
Right. And see, that's the thing. It's those types of substitutions and finding those types of things that makes all this really possible. So if you do want to cut back on your sugar intake and you do feel that you have an addiction and want to lessen it, things like this, finding those substitutions so you can still satisfy your chocolate craving but not have it be feeding into your addiction.
So let's go back for a minute, because I'm interested in this thing that happens that you describe when people go on a quote-unquote diet, and that the critical period for cravings is around 3 to 4 weeks. That's when people fall off the wagon traditionally. And what happens?
Right. And so the reason why the book is called Why Diets Fail, well, there's really two reasons. One is because when people think about going on a diet or tell themselves, okay, I'm going to go on a diet, they sort of have this subliminal idea that once they go on the diet and accomplish their goal of losing weight or getting into a certain outfit or bathing suit, then they can go off the diet and thereby go back to the old way of eating and their old eating habits. And the truth is that that's just not how it works. If you want to have sustained changes and sustained weight loss and lose weight permanently and have it last, you really need to make changes in the way that you think about food and the way that you act from here on out. It can't be a temporary thing. And so our mindset around what the term diet means has to go from being a short-term thing that we're going to get through to a change in the way in which we live. And the other reason why I think many diets fail is because they don't really recognize this addiction component that can exist. And so you know, there's lots of different programs out there, healthy eating plans, all these different strategies on things that people should eat, and many of them make sense and seemingly should work if people could stick to them, but the problem is that people have a really hard time sticking to them. And why is that? I think it's because a few weeks into it, we start to feel these effects of the addiction. And so if you had been on a diet that was rich in processed foods and you were eating these things regularly and you go on one of these healthy eating plans, well, you're going to start to feel the withdrawal component from those foods. You're going to start to feel lethargic and tired and cranky. And all that's going to make it really, really hard to stick to that healthy eating plan. So recognizing that there is a withdrawal component that can emerge that's going to make you feel bad for a little while, I think can really help people to sort of move past it and recognize that this is a natural part of the process of changing the way that you eat. You need to change your behavior, and as a result, your brain needs to adapt to the change in the diet.
So we're going to get to the kind of eating plan that you think your research shows is better for people and maybe easier to stick to in a lifetime kind of way. We're talking with neuroscientist Dr. Nicole Avena, who is at the Columbia University New York Obesity Research Center. You do a lot of experiments using rats and what is the link between rats and human brains? I mean, how much can we rely on that?
Yeah, it's a great question. And so one of the reasons why we do rat studies and we also do human studies is because there's lots of questions that we have about the brain that we can't answer with humans. And so specific details about neurotransmitters and specific brain systems that are dysregulated, we can't really study those things in humans. And so there's a strong overlap between the brain systems and the rat and the human. Rats are excellent models for many behaviors that humans exhibit, and particularly feeding behaviors. And so what we can learn from the rat can really tell us a lot about human behavior.
Can you give me an example of, as I think I remember this section in your book, where you talked about an experiment with a rat, and so if you would just give me an example of watching rats do something that would give you a key to how humans would behave.
Sure. Well, when we think about the brain systems that are regulated or that regulate our food intake, you know, so rats are a good example, particularly when we study food intake, because rats forage for food. They have to search out food, and so they engage many of the same systems that we do in order to do that. So they use their visual system, they use their auditory system, they use all of their senses in order to determine whether or not foods are considered a good idea to eat or a bad idea to eat. They can also get many of the different psychological components to eating that humans can, such as a conditioned taste aversion. For those of you who aren't familiar with that, that's when you eat something and it makes you sick. Let's just say you have, you know, you go to a restaurant and you have a bad sandwich or, you know, some food that's maybe, you know, had gone rotten and you get sick from it. That enlists the systems in your brain that are the same systems that are enlisted when an animal, like a rat, develops that same type of aversion. So we've learned a lot about what happens in the brain with respect to different types of eating based on what we've learned from these studies that are done in our lab rats.
Okay. Would you stay right where you are? Because I have so many more questions for you. I want to know, for instance, why we have this tendency to think that things that are sweet are actually safe, because you point out why that is true. And I want to get into the eating plan that you think does account for health weight loss and is something you can stick to. We'll be right back with Dr. Nicole Avena, a neuroscientist at Columbia University. Why diets fail. I'm Faith Middleton. It is great to have you listening, and I have to say great to have this conversation with neuroscientist Dr. Nicole Avena of Columbia University. Her book is called Why Diets Fail, and it is, she believes, because we are, based on her research, we are addicted to sugar. And so the idea is that sugar isn't poison, but it certainly triggers all kinds of things that sabotage walking around with a proper weight. But how about for your build? What about people whose genes are said to be configured in such a way that almost no matter what they put in their mouths, the weight sticks? You know, what about that? Does it have to do with diet for some people, for everybody?
Right. No, that's a great point. I'm glad you brought it up. And it's important to note that, you know, this concept of addiction to food, while I think it can be useful for a lot of people, it certainly does not explain all types of overweight and all types of obesity. As you suggest, there's people out there who have a genetic propensity to just contain more weight and to carry more weight. And so I think that genetics combined with our environment is what really is driving the obesity epidemic. And so I think that the sugar addiction component of this is somewhat of a combination of maybe a little bit genetics and a little bit of the environment.
So people who are super driven by sugar in certain foods, it could be a gene arrangement that's causing that?
It could be, yeah. There's actually been, there's some classic studies that have looked, interestingly, at alcoholics, and they've found that if they look back, people who are alcoholics, if they look at their parents and grandparents, they actually are often reported to have a really strong sweet tooth. And so there seems to be this somewhat of a genetic link between having a sweet tooth or preferring sweet foods and alcoholism. And that's actually one of the sort of early studies that was reported that kind of got me interested in thinking about how there might be other overlaps between sweets or food intake and drug use. More recently, there's been some studies that have begun to look at certain types of alleles of genes. So we all have our genes, and there's alleles on certain genes. And there's been some studies that have linked alleles of the dopamine gene to food addiction. And so I think we're going to start to see more and more research coming out about the genetic component of this now that this field is, I think, starting to get more popular and more people are studying it.
Well, why are you doing this research? Do you hope to invent something? Or tell me what's motivating you?
Well, you know, I think that I got interested in this really early on when I was actually in graduate school at Princeton, and it was really my PhD project. I started graduate school and was in a lab that studied motivation and what led people to eat in certain ways or do drugs or not do drugs, and it was really sort of just an overall lab that was studying why people do certain things. And you know, this whole idea of whether or not foods and drugs shared similar brain mechanisms led to the idea that, well, maybe some of the foods that we see in our modern food environment, they're combinations of excess amounts of sugars and fats and salts and caffeine and all these ingredients that you would never see in this proportion in nature. And so we started thinking that, well, maybe these foods are acting more like drugs in the sense that they're overstimulating these brain systems that are put in place to just reinforce behavior or to motivate us to do certain things. And that might explain why some people find it difficult to control their intake. So I think my motivation behind all this is to really try to get a better understanding of why people find it so difficult to control their food intake. I mean, we have a huge public health problem in our hands right now. We have, you know, over almost three-quarters of the country overweight. We have many children becoming overweight and obese, diabetes, increased risk for cancer, heart disease. This is not a problem that's going to go away anytime soon. So I'm hoping that this type of research will help some people to identify ways in which they might be able to get control of it.
There are theories that A lot of this has to do with the fact that we're not eating what's called clean food, that there are so many additives, there's so many chemical manipulations, lab-created things in the food that it would explain why if you go to Europe and you're eating cleaner food or you're at a spa and you're eating cleaner food, the weight doesn't seem to stick as much. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I think that there is some truth to that. I think, you know, if you look at the processed foods that tend to contain excess amounts of sugars and fats and these other things we're talking about today, they are containing lists of ingredients that are a mile long. And many of the ingredients I can't even pronounce. And I have a PhD. And it's just, you know, very difficult to really get a sense of what we're consuming when the food products that we seem to be consuming regularly don't really look much like food anymore. They look more like lists of chemicals. And again, you know, I think that that's something that we need to learn more about so we can better understand the long-term effects of eating a diet that's predominated by those types of foods as opposed to eating a more whole food diet or a clean diet, as you say.
If you eat a lot of fat, you're probably going to put on a ton of weight. If you eat a lot of sugar, you're probably going to put on a ton of weight. I don't know what we would say about salt. So my question is, why are you so singling out sugar here?
Right. So that's a great question. We started off studying sugar because sugar had been identified as the type of food that was particularly problematic for people to cut back on. This concept of sugar addiction has been around actually for quite a while. There had been a lot of people out there who had been saying that they felt that they were addicted to sugar, they couldn't control their intake of carbohydrates, and for them, that was the thing that was leading them to not be able to control their food intake and to not be able to lose weight. And I had read about some of these anecdotal reports and these accounts early on in my career, and I thought it was really interesting because although a lot of people had been talking about it, there weren't any scientific studies on it. There really hadn't been any studies conducted to determine whether or not sugar could be addictive. And so that's kind of where I came into the picture, and we started doing a series of different experiments. So we started off focusing on sugar. We've more recently begun to look at combinations of different types of sugars and fats because, as you know, not everybody eats pure sugar. We tend to eat combinations of sugars and fats and other things. And so it seems that sugar is the ingredient that's in so many of the products that we consume. We seem to see these addiction-like responses emerging because, as I think you said earlier in the show, it's in almost 80% of the food products that we buy in the grocery store. And so it's really hard to get away from sugar, and I think that's why it's being singled out as the food that seems to be particularly problematic. When we do studies looking at just plain fat, and so we have done studies like that, we don't see these profound signs of addiction emerging. So there does seem to be something special about the sugar that seems to be producing these effects on the brain that's leading to this cascade of addiction.
People have gotten so into this that they now classify sugars in different categories. And you, in fact, have a chart where there are about 65 or 70 kinds of sugars with names I've seen before but didn't know they were actual sugars. And so that raises the question of what's a naturally occurring sugar? Is one better? You know, what about sugar in that naturally occurs in fresh fruit,
right?
Versus something like honey,
right? So the chart that you're referring to is actually all the different names for sugar. So you have to remember that sugar is really an umbrella term, and a lot of times when we look on the back of a food product and look at the ingredients list, you might not see the word sugar, so you might think, oh, okay, this is good, it doesn't have any sugar. But it might have fruit concentrate, or it might have rice syrup. Mm-hmm. And those are actually code words for sugar. Those are other terms that are used for what we consider to be sugar. And so that's why it's important to know all the different names that are out there that describe what we sort of know as generally as sugar. Sugar isn't just sucrose, which is the white sugar you put in your coffee, and it isn't just high fructose corn syrup, which is the food additive that's in most of the processed foods that we consume. There's a whole host of different names for sugar that are often on those ingredients lists, so it's important to know what they are. Now, in terms of which types of sugars are better or worse in terms of more natural, I think it's important to note that when we're talking about what kinds of sugars you should eat or are best to eat, I think it's important to think about the type of food that contains the sugar. So, for instance, let's say an apple. To me, an apple is a really good source of sugar because it does contain naturally occurring forms of sugar in the form of fructose and glucose, but it also contains nutrients and fiber. Mm-hmm. And the proportion of the fiber to the amount of sugar that's in those apples is really good. Whereas if we take another product that might be similar, like apple sauce, the two might seem kind of similar, but if you look at a jar of apple sauce, that's going to contain a lot of added sugar. It's also going to have some of the fiber taken out during the process of processing the whole apples. And so I think that it's important to think about the type of food that we're consuming and try to consume foods that contain sugar in their natural form.
I've seen people say, well, you know, honey is from bees, and so, you know, I'm participating in this whole natural chain. And I think, well, you know, there's palm sugar is from palms. So, you know, what is the difference here?
Right. I think it's important. I've heard similar stories. People often talk about stevia, and they'll say, well, stevia is great because it's natural. It's from the stevia plant. But I tell people, unless you're growing the stevia plant in your yard or unless you have honeybees in your yard and you're collecting the honey, it's still processed in some way. There's still a process that it's going through from that honeybee nest to your table where you're putting it on the foods that you're consuming. So I think it's best to, you know, keep that in mind when we're thinking about the sugars that we're using. And I think another idea would be to try to avoid adding sugar to things. Or if you're going to add sugar, try to add it in the form of fruit, where you're going to then get those added nutrients and added fiber as well, because that can mitigate the effects that the sugar has on our blood sugar levels.
When it's a thing like making hot chocolate or having a cup of coffee or a cup of tea, what is it that people are supposed to sweeten it with?
Yeah, it's a good question. And, you know, I mean, I think that it boils down to deciding in your life where all the sugars exist. And so let's just say that, and one of the tasks that I have in the book is for people to make a food diary and write down over the course of a few days all the things that you eat so you can identify where the sugars lie and so you can see where you're getting a lot of sugar. If you're one of those people who just has to have a little bit of sweetness in their coffee and they, you know, you can't make the adjustment to maybe have it black or maybe just have it with a little bit of milk instead, then it's a good idea to try to maybe cut sugars out of another part of your diet and then use a small amount of sugar in your coffee. But I think that identifying where you can cut it out in other places is really the way to go, and making sure that there you make substitutions that are going to be for more healthy methods.
Okay, so let's get into the kind of eating plan that you think is sustainable and that and how, because if you're going to get off most of the sugar that you consume and be careful about the kind of carbs, because carbs get read by the body as sugar, right?
Yes.
Yes. Especially the simple carbs. So the potato chips, it end up being read as sugar. So really, I'm eating a bag of sugar. what should we be doing?
Right. So in the book, we outline what we call the sugar freedom plan. And so this is really a 5-step plan that people can follow to try to get the sugars out of their diet and replace them with things that are going to be sustainable. And so one of the sort of goals here is to come up with a way in which you can eat that's going to last. Because again, we don't want to advocate a diet. We want to advocate a way of living. And the other thing is it has to be something that is doable. I think a lot of people get overwhelmed by the idea of, you know, quitting sugar or going off of sugar because it seems to be such a tumultuous task. Because if you think about how many food products contain sugar and how much sugar we're eating, it almost seems overwhelming at first to try to think about how you might cut it all out. So the first thing I suggest is that people cut out sugar-sweetened beverages. And so depending on the individual, this may be more or less difficult. I know many people who have, you know, a 2-liter of soda a day habit, and so for them it's going to take a few weeks to cut back on the sugar-sweetened beverages and to get that out of their system. Other people might find that a little bit easier because if you're not regularly consuming those things, if you're not consuming soft drinks, you're not consuming fruit juices, then it's going to be a little bit easier. So I suggest that people cut those out completely, and the reason why is because they actually have no nutritional value other than the calories. And those are calories that we could be getting from other sources of food that contain nutrients and other sources of energy that are going to be better for us than just basically empty calories.
So here are sample meals in the sugar freedom plan that you have. For breakfast, eggs, bacon, ham, sausage, omelets. You can add in ham, cheese, mushrooms, onions, tomatoes, avocado, salsa, black olives, bacon, salt, and pepper. I'm making myself hungry. Sugar-free yogurt, fruit and milk, cheese, sausage, ham, roll-ups. Now, lunch would be, a salad. Go easy on the croutons, a low-carb dressing or oil and vinegar, a meat and cheese salad, a crab salad, egg salad, tuna salad, chicken salad, hamburgers, chicken lettuce wraps, turkey lettuce wrap, peanut butter sandwich, soups, chili, and then snacks would be nuts or cheese and ham and sausage with mustard, peanut butter, avocado, a piece of fruit, dinner, the usual suspects, chicken, turkey, hamburgers, meatloaf, ribs, but use a sugar-free barbecue sauce or sugar-free ketchup, steaks, all kinds of meats, game, broccoli, cauliflower, zucchini, sprinkled with Parmesan and butter, all kinds of fish, shellfish, shrimp, lobster with butter, and drinks, water, tea, coffee, and sugar-free stuff. Okay, so does this mean no dessert? Are we done with dessert? Is that it?
You know, I think that, you know, it depends on the individual. I think the whole point of this plan is to have it be tailored so that you can have it be a sustainable thing. I think that in the beginning, if you're really working hard to try to cut out the sugars, the desserts should go. I think that mm-hmm. we should be focusing on rewarding our behaviors with other things. People often use dessert as sort of a reward to themselves for, you know, completing the meal or having a good day or, you know what, let's have dessert to celebrate.
And it tastes good.
And it tastes good. But I think that, you know, we really need to change our relationship with food. And I think a lot of the overeating and a lot of the excess sugar intake that we see is because people use food to soothe. People use food to medicate. And so I think initially to change your relationship with food, cutting out desserts is the way to go. Now, this doesn't mean that you can never, ever have a piece of cake again or you can never have a cookie again. But I think it's important to get your food intake under control, get the addiction under control so that you're making the decision about how big that dessert's going to be, so that you're making the decision and that you can put the brakes on when you need to. Because often what happens is when people start on this healthy eating plan and then they say, oh, let me have dessert too, that's where things start to go awry. That leads them to then eat more than they intended, and it sort of perpetuates this whole addiction cycle.
Yeah. Okay. Please stay where you are, Dr. Avina, and then we're going to come back and talk more about why diets fail and this preferred way of eating. And we'll do that in about 60 seconds, 90 seconds. Thanks to our producers, Lori Mack and Jonathan McNichol. And I hope you will save the date. Thursday, June 19th, you are invited to attend and be the top judge at the Faith Middleton Food Schmooze Martini Competition. CPTV will be there to film. You can taste at all the cocktail stations, which are works of art in themselves, and then visit the food stations, and you have a ballot and vote for your favorite innovative martini, a cocktail. You cannot beat the dance music. It's a sellout experience to compete as a bartender, but especially to come as a guest with your friends. Go online right now to ctmartini.org, ctmartini.org. It is the most fun of the year to benefit WNPR and CBTV. It is at the Riverview in Simsbury this year. CTMartini.org tickets are $65 and cannot wait to see you there. It is so much fun. We are talking right now with neuroscientist Nicole Avena. She is at the Obesity Research Center at Columbia University. Does lots and lots of experiments and has written this book, Why Diets Fail. And it has a lot to do with our addiction to sugar, which is now 80% of the foods that we consume. And her book is attempting to explain how to end cravings, lose weight, and be as healthy as possible. So let's talk for a second about variety in the diet you choose. And then I want to get to, because if you're starting to change your eating plan and lower the sugar, if not get off it entirely, you are going to go through this withdrawal thing. So you say that in eating the kinds of foods that we talked about that are sugar-free, variety still ends up being a key.
Yes, and I think it's important because, you know, often I think a lot of these other healthy eating programs that are out there will have a more prescriptive approach of, you know, eat these specific foods at these specific times of the day. And the truth is, and studies have shown that people get bored. People want to have a variety in the types of food that they eat. Otherwise, they feel like they're not being fulfilled. And so there are a lot of different options out there. There are a lot of sugar-free alternatives that you can eat. It's just a matter of developing a plan and having a list prepared in your mind so that you know if you go to a restaurant, you know, what are some options that you can eat? What can you pick and choose from? It might not be the entire menu. It certainly won't be the entire menu, but you will have a set of food items that you know are good for you to eat that you can order.
Okay. Now, the craving thing, we said, is at its toughest, its most severe, at about 3-4 weeks into the time when you start a diet or you want to get off sugar. And you can have all kinds of symptoms. You talked about irritability, sadness or depression, headache, just as you would with trying to get off some kind of prescription drug or illegal drug.
Right. And so, you know, I've had a lot of people liken it to the feelings that they get when they quit smoking. I've had many people tell me, former smokers, that the feelings that they got when they were in withdrawal from nicotine are very similar to the feelings that they are in getting when they're trying to get off of sugar and trying to quit sugar. So there are feelings of distress, feelings of irritability, crankiness, you know, lots of those sort of negative affects that go along with what we think about when we just don't feel well. They can be exacerbated by this whole issue related to sugar addiction. One thing I also want to mention is that the withdrawal part of it, it's acute. Now, remember, it doesn't feel great, but you're going to get over it. And people who've, you know, quit drugs and alcohol can attest to this, that you feel lousy for a little bit of time, but then physically you feel better. The part that's really challenging for many people is the craving. Mm-hmm. Now, the cravings are tough, particularly when it comes to food, because cravings can be instigated by cues. And so we might drive down the road and see our favorite fast food restaurant, and that particular logo will set off brain activity that's going to make us want to eat. And it's going to remind us of the taste of that food and remind us of how it made us feel. And so it's really difficult to get over these cues because in our modern food environment, we're constantly bombarded with them. People who quit smoking and people who, you know, are trying to get off of drugs, they, in many ways, are at somewhat of an advantage in that they're not constantly having these cues thrown in their faces. We don't see billboards advertising heroin. We don't see, you know, advertisements for nicotine really anymore because of the regulations that are in place. But it's not the same with food. It's really going to be an uphill battle because we do live in an environment that is really pushing these types of processed foods on us.
203-776-9677. That's 203-776-WNPR to join the conversation with neuroscientist Dr. Nicole Avena of Columbia University, Why Diets Fail. Lynn, welcome to the show. Lynn, are you there?
It's really going to be an uphill battle because we do live in
No, I have no idea what's going on. Lynn's listening to the radio, I think. What about falling off the wagon? Let's say you're off sugar pretty much. Maybe you have just a little bit in your coffee or something. And then you're at a dinner party or whatever the situation is. You're celebrating something and you have a piece of cake or you have, a couple glasses of wine and the sugar thing is going. How do you climb back on the horse, how do you recover from falling off the wagon?
Right. I think, this is something it's bound to happen. Let's face it. We try our best to stick to a healthy eating plan, but things in life happen and, we have those weak moments. And so there's a chance that you might have a relapse or a regression, if you will. And so I think the important thing is to note that it's an isolated incident and you're going to learn from it. And it's not an excuse to just throw in the towel and go back to eating the way that you used to eat. You have to just use it as a learning experience and try to figure out, well, what was it about that particular situation that caused me to eat that way or caused me to eat that thing that I knew I didn't want to eat, but I did anyway. And then that way, the next time you're facing that situation, you'll be better able to cope with it and you'll have a plan. I think that we spend way too much time beating ourselves up about not being able to eat healthy. And the whole goal here is to provide people with a plan and to help them with education so that they can make informed decisions and that they can use what they know about their diet to help them understand why they want to eat certain ways and what they can do to recognize the symptoms of eating in a way that's maybe not in their particular plan.
How important is it to find some combination of what you're talking about that works for an individual? For instance, I eat in what you would call a paleo way. So I have lots of protein and vegetables, and I shy away pretty much from grains and potatoes and, a little bit careful on the dairy. And now I eat that way because I find it delicious. I really love that and could eat this way for the rest of my life. And that's when it hit me. I thought, oh, other times when I've, I'm a food and wine reporter, so I I'm around, a lot of calories get consumed and I have to work at it. So, other diets I've tried in the past, I think I have failed at them, not just for addiction purposes, because I didn't like them.
Yeah, and I think, what I'm advocating with why diets fail, I think it does touch upon some of the paleo-esque type of eating ways. I'm actually just coming back from a meeting in Austin, Texas that was called Paleo FX, which was all about the paleo diet and the paleo lifestyle. I gave a lecture there on food addiction and on sugar addiction because that community was interested in hearing about it. And I think that it's true. Many people have told me that they didn't realize how much they liked certain types of foods until they stopped eating all the sugary processed foods. And I think the reason why that happens is because our palates become sensitized to the sweetness. And so since we're constantly eating all these sugar-rich foods, we don't always taste how sweet other types of foods are. So, for instance, I had a woman once tell me she didn't realize that certain fruits actually tasted sweet. She always felt like she had to add sugar to the fruit, and she thought it was because of the way that the seeds had been developed and the breeding of our plants and whatnot, that maybe the sweetness had been bred out of the fruits in our country. But that wasn't the case. It's just that she wasn't able to really taste the sweetness of the fruit because she had been on this diet that was so loaded down with excess sugars. And so when you change the way you eat, I think you can really develop a new appreciation for the foods that are healthy that you just didn't realize tasted in the way that they do.
Lynn Faith Middleton, welcome to the show with Dr. Nicole Avena.
Thank you very much. I called because I was wondering if within some of her research she's studied the effects of sleep deprivation on people's cravings and inability to control their cravings.
Oh, Lynn, I love this question.
And the reason I ask it is I literally have a group of French students visiting us right now, and it came up in our discussion. All these French students get 9 and 10 hours of sleep a night. My students were stunned because they said basically on average they get from 4 to 6 hours of sleep a night. This is at the high school level.
Yeah, so the question's about sleep. right? Is that, I just want to make
sure. Yes, that's right.
So, yeah, that's such a great question, Lynn, and there is such a strong component to this. You know, there's been lots of studies that have been done that have looked at the role of sleep deprivation and obesity, and there's a really strong link that's being discovered. And so getting enough sleep is so important, and it's really a matter of making it a critical element of our day and finding the time to sleep. And it's awful that we've become, you know, in this pattern in our lives for many of us where sleep has to sort of be secondary in health. But it is a big factor, and it's very important, and there have been some links drawn between obesity and sleep deprivation. Now, in terms of the food addiction and the sugar addiction side of it, there's no studies going on that I'm aware of, but I would hope that we would see some of those down the road.
Yeah, and I would think the sleep deprivation it would lead to a kind of stress eating because you feel miserable and you want to reward yourself with something.
Oh, exactly. You know? Yeah, it's like a way of self-medicating.
Yeah, exactly. Fred Faith Middleton, welcome to the show. Go ahead, Fred.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
I've got two questions. One is, you mentioned stevia, and my wife has moved over to stevia in her hot chocolate every night, and thinking that this is a better way to get her hot chocolate to be sweet. And the other thing is about alcohol. I stopped drinking alcohol thinking, boy, I'm going to drop weight like crazy. I didn't lose a pound. So those are my two questions.
All right.
Yeah, well, the question about stevia, you know, I've told, you know, people often ask me this, you know, is it better to use stevia or is it better to just use regular sugar? I often advocate, you know, again, this goes for any low-calorie or no-calorie sweetener. Don't forget that it's the sweet taste that can activate these brain reward systems that can perpetuate the addiction. So if the goal is to try to get off of the addiction or mitigate the addiction, using something that still tastes sweet isn't necessarily going to fix the problem. It's more of a band-aid. And so later on, you're still going to have these urges to eat sugar and overeat sugar. Mm-hmm. And so if you need to use it as a crutch to get off of sugar or to cut down on your intake, I think it's a good idea. But I think the ultimate goal would be to try not to use artificial sweeteners or sweeteners in general, and instead try to use things like, you know, fruits. You know, it's a little bit difficult. I have to come up with a solution for coffee, but I often drink tea. And so when I drink tea, instead of adding sugar or honey to my tea, I'll throw a couple of berries in there. And, you know, that will sweeten it up in a way that's a bit more natural than, you know, just throwing in some sugar.
I put spices in my tea. So, you know, Indian spices makes it delicious.
Yeah, that's another good idea. Just coming up with something to jazz it up. And again, it doesn't have to be sweet. If you just need some flavoring, it doesn't always have to be sweet. So spices is another good idea.
Now, here's someone who stopped alcohol and thought the weight would fall off, because I know many people who have done that and the weight has fallen off.
Yeah, you know, it depends on the individual, but I know many people who also have not lost weight. And the reason why I think that can be is because if you're replacing the time that you were spending drinking alcohol with maybe nibbling on food or having snacks, then your calories are going to equal out. And so I think it's important to think about what are you doing in place of drinking the alcohol. If it was a few hundred calories from beer that's now being replaced, or wine with being replaced with, you know, maybe larger portions of food or having dessert now instead, that's going to sort of cancel out the calories and, you know, cause you to not have the weight loss that you might have expected.
Okay. Rex Faith Middleton, welcome to the show, Rex.
Thanks. Yeah, I had a question about using food labels, because sugar is identified on food labels, and I usually try to look at the labels, but I don't know how many grams of sugar I should be having, and is that even a helpful way to monitor the sugar that you take in?
And we have about a minute to go. That's a great question, Rex, because the sugar, as we just heard, comes under so many names that it's hard to even identify if it has sugar. So I look at, you know, grams of sugar to see, you know, does that help me? What do you think, Dr. Ravina?
Well, it's a great question, and the FDA is actually considering revising our nutrition labels to make it more clear how much sugar is in them. Because if you note, on the back of the nutrition label, for all the other things, we have a percentage of daily value. So it tells you the percentage of what you're supposed to have for fat each day. Mm-hmm. But we don't have that for sugar. And so hopefully we'll see some changes in the food nutrition label guidelines soon, so that it'll become a lot more apparent. Also, they're proposing to add in a line that'll indicate how much sugar is added sugar versus just sugar that's there naturally, which
very
is a
good.
Very important distinction.
Hey, thanks so much for being on the show and for writing this book.
Oh, thank you.
Dr. Nicole Avina, if you'd like to find out more about the book, go to our website right now, WNPR.org. Search programs for the Faith Middleton Show. As always, this show is about the richness of life. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.